From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. College freshmen are most vulnerable to heavy drinking in the first month and a half of the fall semester. How might it affect the rest of their college career? We hear from a University of Maryland College Park professor who studies college drinking, and we learn what Frostburg State University is doing to address it. Then, Caesars, owner of Baltimore's new Horseshoe Casino, has struggled financially since the recession and is deep in debt. We talk with Mark Reuter of the online news site Baltimore Brew about what that means for the Horseshoe. Plus, this weekend, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra will perform a piece that hasn't been heard in a concert hall for 80 years. We learn the story of how Ode to the Star-Spangled Banner found its way into the BSO's first concert of the season. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Most colleges and universities in Maryland are at least 3 weeks into their fall semester. And if we go on research, that means many college freshmen are at least 3 weeks into their peak drinking season. According to the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, college freshmen are most vulnerable to heavy drinking during the first 6 weeks of school. Student safety has been in many people's thoughts lately after a Towson University freshman, Julia Margaret Ratnaraj, died in an off-campus apartment a week and a half ago. Friends said she had been drinking, although the extent of the role alcohol played in her death is not yet clear. She died from head and neck injuries sustained when she fell into a glass door, and her death was ruled an accident. We want to get a better understanding of what some local colleges are doing to prevent harm and address the issue of excessive drinking. For starters, we asked two seniors at UMBC, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, how they define excessive drinking. Both are 21, over the legal drinking age. We hear first from Yujing Kang, then from Caroline, who preferred to use only her first name.
I think excessive drinking is when it starts to begin affecting your schoolwork, your relationships, even your coherence of what is going on.
I think that it's basically just a lack of inhibitions. This could be the level of seeing people kind of push or shove each other, the touchy-feeliness of being drunk that you see a lot on college campuses.
Joining me now is Dr. Amelia Aria, Associate Professor in the University of Maryland College Park's Department of Behavioral and Community Health and Director of the Center on Young Adult Health and Development at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Dr. Aria, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also with us, again, on the line from Frostburg State University is Jeff Graham, FSU's Assistant Vice President for Student and Educational Services. Jeff Graham, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you. My pleasure to be part of the conversation.
Dr. Rhea, you heard what those UMBC students said. Would you define for us what constitutes excessive drinking?
Excessive drinking is defined as four or more drinks on one occasion for a female and five or more drinks on one occasion for a legal age male. So you can really just define it on the basis of how much and how often you're drinking.
What does the research tell us about the percentage of students who drink and how much?
Well, while we find that close to 40% drink excessively in any given time, almost two-thirds at a lot of universities are not drinking at all or very little. And that's something that we're trying to do is give those non-drinking students a louder voice.
What factors play into how much a student drinks?
Drinking patterns are established in high school, so that plays a big role, and related to that are parent attitudes. So parents who allow drinking in high school are more likely to have children who go on to drink excessively in college. So the earlier you drink, the more likely it is that you'll have problems later. Another big issue is access and availability, or having a false ID that allows you to have access to underage drinking and social activities. And then having overinflated attitudes about the social benefits of alcohol or the stress-reducing power of alcohol, which really are not true. And also they tend to underestimate the negative consequences of drinking.
Jeff, what kind of education does Frostburg try to give students especially new students?
Well, certainly we have a population level training in terms of requiring all students, whether they're incoming freshmen or incoming transfer students, pre-matriculation, we require them to complete an online education program on alcohol prevention as well as sexual assault prevention. And certainly, you know, we have some environmental level programs that involve deterrence activities in terms of how we police communities and how we interact with our community coalitions.
Amelia, do you have a sense of what messages students at College Park get?
It's pretty much the same, but I think that one of the most important things that we're learning from the research is that education alone is not going to prevent high-risk drinking. That it leads to more educated drinkers, but in order to change the behavior, you're going to need a more intensive approach that identifies high-risk drinkers and deals with their drinking patterns one-on-one. And you're also going to have to look at the environment to reduce access and availability to alcohol in order to reduce the problem, because education alone does not seem to change behavior.
So even when young people know the risks, they take them anyway.
Exactly. I mean, they are wired. They're neurodevelopmentally wired to take risks. So if you tell them that something is risky and they're a risk taker, they're much more likely to say, bring it on. I'll take that risk and I'll tell a great story about it.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Amelia Aria, Director of the Center on Young Adult Health and Development at the University of Maryland School of Public Health, and also with Jeff Graham, Frostburg State University's Assistant Vice President for Student and Educational Services. When we spoke about a year ago, we talked a lot about the culture of drinking and an expectation that students have, especially freshmen. And so I want to play another clip from UMBC senior Eugene Kang.
And I think this ties a lot kind of with like the distance that even comes with the social media, maybe, that is so present within our generation, where we're not really talking to people face-to-face all the time. You know, we're interacting a lot over electronic means. And so what is that common ground that we want to kind of reach for? It seems to be alcohol.
So let me ask either of you, what about this idea of alcohol as a common bond? How do you address that mindset?
Well, I think from the research that we've done, we've seen that in the earlier years of college, early in the college career, students do buy into the fact that that is the fabric of their bond. But then when you ask them in their fourth year of college what impeded them to achieving their goals, a lot of them point to peer relationships and partying, and they look at trying to get a job and they say, wow, I wasted a lot of time and it was really distracting to see things that way.
So if there were some way to get the freshmen to understand what the seniors understand. Jeff, what are your thoughts about alcohol as a bond and how you address that?
You know, obviously there's a lot of social learning theory that takes place in the development of students as they're, you know, kind of leaving that adolescent phase into young adulthood. And social influences can be very powerful. You know, affiliation can be very powerful. I think that's why you see that there tends to be higher drinking rates among students affiliated with Greek life, meaning fraternities and sororities, or students affiliated with athletic teams. We specifically do a significant level of program for our student athlete population that's really geared toward, you know, changing behaviors and educating students about other ways that they could affiliate. And we do similar programs for Greeks.
Dr. Aria, should we think of these first weeks of heavy drinking among freshmen as a passing phase, or does it set up a pattern that continues?
Well, again, what we've shown from the research is that students who drink excessively in their first year are likely to escalate their drinking patterns over the college career. And once people turn 21, their drinking actually increases. So I think it's a little bit of a myth to say that the problem is only among freshmen. Certainly the problem even gets worse. So the time to intervene and identify high-risk students might be the first year.
So for the student who thinks drinking may be causing some damage in their lives or the lives of another student they care about. Where can they go for help on campus?
Most colleges and universities are going to have a counseling center or counseling and psychological services, and that's always a good place to start. Many universities are also going to have alcohol and other drug prevention offices that can be very useful, and I think that you're going to see an increasing number of colleges and universities that are using kind of a basic kind of screening model model where they're actually screening students in a number of different venues, whether it be a university health center or through the student conduct office or other areas where they're able to kind of funnel students, if you will, into either some kind of brief motivational interaction or some kind of maybe treatment if necessary. But again, drinking in general, it's very difficult for young people, let alone an older adult population, to admit when they have some issues with alcohol and actually seek treatment or seek resources that can help them.
It's a big challenge. I really appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Amelia Aria is Associate Professor in the Department of Behavioral and Community Health at College Park and Director of the Center on Young Adult Health and Development at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Jeff Graham is Assistant Vice President for Student and Educational Services at Frostburg State University. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also there, more of this interview, and more of our interviews with Eugene Kang and Caroline with their ideas about ways to reduce excessive drinking. I'm Sheila Cass, just ahead, taking the financial pulse of the new casino. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In gambling, it said the house always wins. This has seemed less true of late. Just yesterday, Trump Plaza in Atlantic City closed, the fourth casino to close there this year. And Caesars Entertainment, which indirectly owns the new Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore, closed its Showboat Casino in Atlantic City a few weeks ago. Just as you might be wondering how financially healthy casinos in Maryland can be with so many losses up the road in New Jersey, along comes the online news site Baltimore Brew with an in-depth look at Caesars' money troubles. Mark Reuter, senior reporter for The Brew, wrote that three-part series and joins us now to talk about whether those problems have a bearing on the success of Horseshoe. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
You write that Caesars Entertainment hasn't turned a profit in 5 years. Why is that?
Largely because the gambling population, which they depended hugely on 50, 55-year-old plus women, the ones who would be bused en masse down to Atlantic City and other places, that market disappeared after the Great Recession and hasn't reappeared in the last 4 or 5 years. So they have a big hole in their customer base.
And what impact, if any, is there from the surge in gambling in Pennsylvania, in Maryland, in Delaware? Is that having an impact?
Well, it's
the Atlantic City casino.
Oh, absolutely. So Atlantic City has been, hit in two directions. One is that suddenly competition that was never there before sprung up. Remember, Atlantic City was the only legalized gambling center in the East Coast, so it had a huge market. At the same time, is this more structural issue in the casino gambling industry, and that is that the so-called low rollers, the small but regular gamblers who play the slots, which are largely elderly in many cases, have not been playing them with the frequency and using the money that they did 10 years ago.
So one of Caesar's subsidiary owns the Horseshoe Casino, the new casino in Baltimore.
Caesar's is the lead owner of the Baltimore Casino, and through a number of different companies, but including the very troubled so-called Bad Caesar's company. But also significantly, it has a long-term lease as the operator of the casino. So it's a major stock owner and is the sole operator.
So could the money problems that you write about affect the Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore?
It could. Over time, it's not something that we would see directly. One of the big issues in these suits that have been proliferating on Wall Street by angry bondholders is that Caesars was transferring its good assets into new companies and leaving behind the bad assets, the losses, in the old company. Now, the Baltimore Casino, the Horseshoe Casino, is part of the Good Caesars Group that was established around 16 months ago. Several of these lawsuits are asking that those assets be returned or be relinquished. So there is a possibility that Caesars would have to readjust and potentially have to surrender, perhaps surrender parts or all of its ownership of the casino to bondholders, which it owes so much money to.
That's Mark Reuter of Baltimore Brew here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a three-part series he's written about the money problems plaguing Caesars Entertainment, one of the owners of the Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore. So what I'm trying to understand is, are the factors that created the losses Caesars has felt, are they at play for the Horseshoe Casino?
We don't know yet. We don't know that. What we know is that it is a company, contrary to sort of the impression that was given by city and state officials that, oh, we're getting one of the biggest, snazziest companies from Las Vegas. Actually, we're getting a company that's swimming in debt and who has subsidiary companies that are under serious disputes with bondholders, and with analysts in Wall Street saying this company sooner or later in one shape or form is going to have to go into receivership. So there's the money problems that could result in potentially down the line job losses and other things. The immediate question facing the casino is, what will its revenue stream? Will it be attracting enough casino customers as much as they expected in their projections? How serious is the competition going to be from Maryland Live, which is the current casino, which has done very well for itself and is in local ownership?
And very briefly, new competition.
And then new competition.
That, in 2016.
Right.
National Harbor.
And that is going to be an extremely upscale glitzy Las Vegas-like operation. This casino in Baltimore, they value it at $400 million. And in comparison, National Harbor is way over $1 billion. So they're going to have a lot more attractions. It's going to be a lot bigger. And will that draw people just because of the excitement from Baltimore?
You've raised a lot of questions. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Reuter, he's senior reporter at the online news site The Baltimore Brew. At our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, we've got a link to Mark's series about the money struggles of Caesars Entertainment. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, how the BSO found a piece of music unearthed after 80 years. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
The Baltimore Symphony will kick off its new season on Saturday night with a performance and gala party at the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall. They've already had a busy week. Last Saturday, they performed for a national television audience at Pier 6 as part of the 200th anniversary celebration of the Star-Spangled Banner. And this weekend, the symphony will again keep the national anthem front and center. They'll perform a piece that hasn't seen the light of day for 80 years, an ode to the Star-Spangled Banner by Ferdy Groffay, a classical composer and jazz arranger who is well known in the classical circles for this piece, the Grand Canyon Suite. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guests this morning are Neil Grauer and Nicholas Brown. Neil is an author who has written several books, the most recent being A History of Johns Hopkins Medicine. And Nick Brown is on the staff of the Library of Congress. They're here to tell us the story of how Groffay's ode came to find its way onto the BSO program on Saturday. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Neil, this has really been a cause célèbre for you.
Kind of.
How did this piece come to your attention?
Well, in December 1932, my father and grandfather attended the opening of Radio City Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And my father kept the program. And in the program, which is mind-boggling because it was a four-hour show with everyone from Martha Graham's dance troupe to the Flying Walendas to Ray Bolger, there was a piece of music identified as September 13, 1814, and it was described in the program as being a evocation of the bombardment on Fort McHenry, accompanying a tableau depicting that event. And so I thought that it would be phenomenal if I could find this piece of music and offer it to the BSO for the bicentennial.
Uh-huh. And indeed, you did track it down with Nick's help. So, Nick, was this piece just sort of locked in some vault somewhere in the Library of Congress? How did you find it?
Well, it was buried down below the surface level on Capitol Hill of our James Madison building, where the majority of the music collections live. And we actually have the Ferdy Groffay collection, which is something around 280 boxes of manuscripts, parts, and memorabilia related to his career that his family gifted to the library. Mm-hmm. And so when Neil brought the story to my attention via a mutual colleague, Charles Lim, who is here at Hopkins, and we had worked with Charles previously at the library, we figured out that we would go on a treasure hunt and find this thing. And it turned into a really bizarre project, and I think I inhaled about 2 pounds of dust from the 1930s in the process. But I searched through all these boxes, which weren't entirely sorted in an easy-to-navigate manner. It was something over 200 boxes before I found the actual sheet music that we needed. And what happened when I located it was we determined there were several different versions of the piece. The one that was performed at Radio City Music Hall was the full orchestra version, and Groffay dated that manuscript December 23rd, 1932. We also discovered a version for dance jazz orchestra, which was recorded in 1937 with Ferdy's own orchestra. And then we found some parts and then some peripheral clippings in the scrapbooks and have been working with the BSO since in bringing this project to fruition.
So you've reconstructed the score from these materials and you've got fresh materials for the orchestra to play.
Yes. So
to conduct.
Once we had determined that these parts were suitable for the orchestra, we worked with their library staff and with Matt Spivey, and we all decided
to collect. He's on the administrative staff of the artistic staff of the BSO.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, at the Library of Congress, obviously, you know, it's this vast collection, and I think most lay people like me have the idea that everything's, you know, beautifully organized, it's all in the right file, and if you need something, you just go to some computer and you go, and you got it, right? But not so. I mean, you had to go
schlepping
through boxes. And
correct.
This
well, yeah, part of the problem was that the program from the Radio City called the piece September 13, 1814, but when Nick found it, it was listed under Ode to the Star-Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm. Let's give it a listen. We do have, as you mentioned, Nick, there's this recording from 1937. Here's a bit of Ferdy Groffay's Ode to the Star-Spangled Banner.
Thank you.
So there it is. So now, Nick, explain who's performing it. That's the composer himself, Mr. Groffé, conducting his orchestra, because he had a radio show, and he had a big band or a jazz band that he performed with often, right? So this was broadcast on CBS Radio in 1937.
Yes, and it was his own orchestra, and the recording is part of a series of his audio archival recordings that live down at Florida State University. The Library of Congress has the paper holdings, and then they have most of his audio holdings. And it's up online. Anyone can Google the recording if you want a taste of that jazz orchestra version, which will differ from the version that the BSO is playing.
Yeah, for the big orchestra. So, Neil, what about this piece strikes you? I mean, a little bit later on, there's a little snippet from Yankee Doodle. He works in some other tunes.
Oh, yeah. He works in Rule Britannia. He works in Yankee Doodle. There are slide whistles for the rockets coming over Fort McHenry, and there are drum rolls for the bombs and the rat-a-tat-tat of the of rifles. I should say that in 1932, as I said, the program describes this as being, you know, performed in a conjunction with a tableau recreating the bombardment. And so we have sought to do something similar, in that we got footage from a 2008 History Channel docudrama on the War of 1812 that had scenes depicting the bombardment of Fort McHenry. And we got permission from the Arts and Entertainment Channel to use about, you know, 5 minutes of this footage, which will be broadcast on the BSO's big screen. Not broadcast, will be projected on the BSO's big screen, and they will play the music to accompany it.
Yeah, so with the full orchestra instead of the jazz band. And this is, so you're sort of recreating what they were doing back in Radio City in 1932. That's a hoot. Neil Grauer is the Assistant Director of Editorial Services at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Nicholas Brown is a music specialist at the Library of Congress in Washington on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about Ferdy Groffé, composer Nick Brown, who was a pretty big deal in his time, was he not?
Yes, he was. He had a fascinating background. He kind of worked his way up in life. He had odd jobs when he was a child, working in kitchens and as a newspaper boy and that sort of thing. Then he became a working musician as a violinist and pianist. Eventually, he came into contact with the famous band leader Paul Whiteman. And with Paul Whiteman, he played in the band and then also orchestrated and arranged for the musicians. And then he eventually came into contact with George Gershwin. And the story that makes Groffé such a legend within the library's circles is that Groffé actually orchestrated the jazz orchestra version of Rhapsody in Blue, which was actually the first version performed with Gershwin at the piano and Paul Whiteman conducting. And in 1946, Groffé actually presented that manuscript to the Library of Congress many decades before the rest of his collection arrived.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of that. We don't have Gershwin playing it himself, but this is the arrangement that Ferdy Groffé did of Gershwin's famous Rhapsody in Blue. Of course, if folks who are familiar with that piece, either from hearing it in concerts or hearing it on the United Airlines commercials or something, they're familiar with a large orchestra version. Mm-hmm. This is for a smaller jazz band. And, of course, Groffé's arrangement of the Star-Spangled Banner will be, again, for a large symphony orchestra rather than the small band. Now, when we talk about an arrangement, plenty of people have arranged the Star-Spangled Banner, some composers of great note. Igor Stravinsky comes to mind. He did a rather famous harmonization of the Star-Spangled Banner. Let's give a little listen to that. Stravinsky changes the harmonies ever so slightly. He changes the rhythms here and there. It's certainly recognizable as the Star-Spangled Banner, but it's not by any means a typical orchestration.
Thank you.
course, you know, composers take liberties. That's what they're allowed to do. So Neil Grauer, when Groffet approached this thing, he was really doing not really a strict arrangement of the Star-Spangled Banner, but he was kind of using the Star-Spangled Banner as a launching point to do all sorts of other fiddling about it.
Yeah, to use it as a motif to enliven this panorama. I don't have any idea what they did on the stage of Radio City when mm-hmm. presumably they had a model
for the tableau you're talking about.
The tableau, presumably. Mm-hmm. They did have an actor named Taylor Holmes, who later became a famous character actor in Washington playing judges and things like that. And he performed as Francis Scott Key. But I found a review at the time that said that he didn't say anything. So he just reacted, you know, probably that's melodramatically.
Right. Like Saturday Night Live, you know, acting.
Right.
And Nick Brown, before we go, just real quick, there's going to be an exhibition at the Meyerhof at the gala on Saturday that includes some artifacts and some things related to Francis Scott Key, as well as the premiere of this piece.
That's correct. And also on the program are works by Aaron Copland. And Copland is, of course, another linchpin in our music collections at the library. So we're going to be bringing up some special treasures and manuscripts related to all of the music on the program. And this is an effort for the Library of Congress to convey this project that we have called Songs of America, in which we're capturing and providing to the public an opportunity to learn about how music offers a depiction of American history.
Well, it's going to be fun stuff. Well, Neil Grauer and Nick Brown, appreciate your coming by and break a leg on Saturday night. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Tom.
Neil Grauer and Nicholas Brown will be part of a panel tomorrow about various arrangements of the Star-Spangled Banner that starts at noon. It's at the Library of Congress in Washington. And as we mentioned, the BSO will perform Ferdy Groffé's Ode on Saturday night at their annual gala at the Meyerhof in Baltimore. Their program also includes Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with the Marcus Roberts Trio, Copland's Lincoln Portrait, narrated by Center Stage's Kwame Kwe Arma, and Copland's Old American Songs, sung by the Morgan State University Choir. Marin Alsop conducts, and if you'd like to skip the black tie gala dinner part of the evening, you can get tickets for just the concert. We'll have a link with more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website. Again, come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Elizabeth Sherwood and Payam Agagasam. Coming up Friday, a radio tour of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Theater's new digs in downtown Baltimore. I hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.